And I realized, and the message I give to students today is, it's important that you be smart enough and work hard enough and all these other things. Those are necessary but insufficient to be successful. There's a lot of luck involved, and you don't have control over that.
That's true.
And I have been extremely lucky, and I'm not going to go into other stories about that. But it's very humbling to appreciate that.
I'm John Fox, director of the Del Monte Institute for Neuroscience at the University of Rochester, and I'm delighted to welcome you to another episode of Neuroscience Perspectives. We've taken the podcast on the road this year, and we're here in lovely Chicago at the Society for Neuroscience meeting, and I'm absolutely honored to be joined by Professor Murray Sherman, the Morris Goldblatt Professor of Neurobiology at the University of Chicago. His research uses the visual and somatosensory pathways to study thalamic functional organization and thalamocortical relationships. His work has been integral to informing our understanding of the visual pathways. He's a recipient of the Sloan and Guggenheim Fellowship and has an honorary degree from Oxford University. Murray, thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Probably most people out there don't really know much about the thalamus at all, but if you think of it as somebody going through a basic, you know, neuroscience 101 course, they'll learn that this is this little structure in the middle of the brain and it acts as a relay, but it's so much more than that. Are there a few things you want to say about, like, the importance of the thalamus?
I'm going to start off with an anecdote. In the 1980s, I happened to be in London. I've told this story to many, many people, but probably not to your audience. I was in London and the Museum of Natural History there announced a new display they had on the human brain. And I was a tourist there. I thought it would be fun to go in and see what this looked like. When I walked into the exhibit, the first thing I saw was a large three-dimensional model of the human visual system in which they had the retina projecting directly to cortex.
They left it out.
No thalamus. I was naturally a bit upset. I mentioned that just because it indicates how far the appreciated thalamus has come. Nobody would do that today, I'd like to think.
Yeah.
So, yes. But textbooks still depict the thalamus as merely to get information from the periphery to cortex. For instance, in the visual system, they'll mention maybe that the retina projects to the lateral geniculate nucleus, which is part of the thalamus that projects to cortex, and that's all it gets. Most of thalamus, by textbook views, is ignored and is pretty much an enigma. What Ray Guillory and I emphasized was actually most of thalamus we now recognize is there to serve as a communication hub between cortical areas. And so that means that most of thalamus is playing a very important role in how cortex functions writ large. Mm-hmm. And it's not just there to relay information from the periphery, but it is very important in cortical functioning and how cortical areas communicate together and coordinate for important cognitive functions.
Excellent, yeah.
So I think that's where we are today, and I think finally this has caught hold in the field.
Right. I mean, correct me now if I'm wrong, like in the visual nucleus, this lateral geniculate nucleus, actually the major inputs, the bulk of the inputs are coming back from cortex rather than coming from the periphery. Yeah,
they come back from cortex, but this may be a bit too technical. There are two kinds of excitatory pathways in the brain, and this is something else that Ray and I worked on. One is we call driver. It carries information. The retina input to the lateral geniculate nucleus is a driving input because it's carrying the information. The feedback from cortex to the LGN, to the lateral geniculate nucleus, is what we call modulatory.
Right.
It's not carrying basic information, but it is affecting, through complicated modulatory synaptic functions, the gain of retinogeniculate transmission and other factors of retinal input, and how it's relayed to cortex. That distinction, we think, is very important to parse out how circuits operate, to understand how you identify drivers versus modulators in thalamic and cortical circuitry.
And then, you know, there's been a couple of decades of extraordinary work on oscillatory dynamics and cortex and that, but the first place I read about changes in modes of information transfer was in
burst
and tonic modes by Sherman and Guillory. So
So thalamic relay cells can operate in two different kinds of firing mode, which are called, as you said, burst and tonic. And we think that the tonic mode, I don't want to go into too much technical detail it is a bit complicated. I'll just say that the tonic mode is what we would call a very linear mode. There's not a lot of distortion in the signal. And the signal that it transfers to cortex, which is a very reliable copy of the retinal input, has a relatively weak influence on cortex, but it gets there. The burst mode is a much more active mode, a very high frequency barrage of action potentials. It's very nonlinear. It does not portray a very reliable map of what's going on in the periphery. There's a lot of nonlinear distortion, but it provides a very powerful input to cortex. We call it a wake-up call.
Right.
It's when no retinal signal has been coming by for a long time, there are mechanisms that cause the relay cell to switch to burst mode so that when a new signal comes along, it alerts cortex, something's coming along, now you better pay attention to it.
Very good. Yeah.
That's sort of a poor man's description of what we think is going on.
No, but it's a very elegant one.
That feedback from cortex that I mentioned is modulatory is important for controlling which of those two modes is going to be happening in the relay.
Right, right. So much more complicated dynamics in that little tiny nucleus in the thalamus than...
It's complicated, but I guess the take-home message is that the information being relayed by the thalamus can either be a pure information route or a wake-up call after not much has been happening, that now things are going to start happening
and
pay attention to it.
Right. One of our major connections, which is the late, great Ray Guillory, who was your longtime collaborator.
Yes.
And, just open the floor to tell us a little bit about you and Ray and how you got together and how meaningful that was.
Ray was absolutely vital to my career right from the beginning. I met him when I was a graduate student. I think it was 1968. And he really impressed me from the beginning because he invited me to Wisconsin, where he was at the time, to talk about my thesis research. And he treated me like his equal, not as a student, right from the beginning. For whatever reason, he took a liking to me, and we were collaborating ever since. It's a collaboration that lasted almost 50 years until he died in 2017. We started off by working on some research projects together in the 70s, and that eventually evolved to more theoretical workings that we were doing. We wrote three monographs, a number of theoretical essays, and it was a delight for me to work with him. And everybody that knew him, and I'm sure this is true of you as well, loved the man and respected him. He was such an important person in the field.
Yeah. Deeply decent human being and a titan in the field. And you two boys really wrote the book on thalamus.
Well, he was a titan in the field, and the reason I'm here is largely because of his influence.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't say enough about that.
Outstanding. And usually the question about I have the great honor of being the editor-in-chief of the European Journal of Neuroscience, and Ray was the first editor of the journal when it started in 1989.
So did you have much interaction with him?
Oh, just a little bit. Of course, the connection was through Paul Bolam, who was very close with Ray and was the co-editor with me at the time. But of course, it's shoulders of giants. I mean, it's a great legacy for me personally to have been connected to that. So.
The one thing about Ray is that he was, in one way, an old-fashioned traditional anatomist, but he always thought functionally, which was unusual for a neuroanatomist at that time. And that's what made him special, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's a great point. I jump an off point, really. This sort of transition from the era of anatomy and really trying to trace out the circuits and understand those circuits to thinking about them functionally. And you really had a first-row seat to that transition. Would you tell us a little bit about that and how you think about, let's say, your grounding in anatomy going onwards from there?
Yeah, I like to point out that when I started as a graduate student, there were, I think, no neuroscience departments. Neuroscience was not recognized as a field. People interested in the brain tended to work in anatomy departments or physiology departments or psychology departments. And the field obviously has, during my career, has emerged to become one of the most important fields in biomedical research, which I think is a good example of why correlation doesn't mean cause and effect.
Right.
But I was privileged to see all that happen during my career. And, you know, I always felt that neuroscience is one of these fundamental issues that humans have been concerned about since long before history was recorded. That and cosmology are the two main things. So it's every university, every major research entity should have something like neuroscience as part of what it's doing.
Right.
And that more and more universities now have it as a central part of their research program, which I find, a real sign of the importance of the field today.
Yeah. And if I may say it, I mean, the emergence of neuroscience as an important field is because of folks like you and Ray and the people that I say that seriously. I know you're modest about these things. Tell me how you found neuroscience. What was the trajectory? You know, what does young Murray Sherman, youngster?
Okay, so, the Society for Neuroscience has a series of short autobiographies written by some senior people, and I wrote one of these. So anybody who's interested in the details can find it there. It's available online. I don't want to be too repetitive, but I'll tell you my story. There's a lot of name dropping, I have to say in advance. I wanted to be a physicist from early days in high school, as long as I can remember. And I wanted to go to the college that had the best physics. And for me, at the time, that was Caltech. That's where I went.
Right.
And we happened to be the only class that Richard Feynman taught. So he taught us for 2 years. Richard Feynman, for those that don't know, was a fairly famous Nobel laureate in physics. He was a very entertaining teacher, and he would often stop teaching physics and tell anecdotes.
Yeah.
And every so often he would stop and say, he knew that most of you guys, because there was only men there at Caltech, there were no women yet, I want to be physicists, but I'm telling you a much more interesting area to do research in is brain research. Neuroscience wasn't a word then. And he said that several times. I'd like to think that that had a big impact on me. It may have, but honestly, I'm not certain. But maybe coincidentally, after my first year, I wanted a summer job there. And one opened up, now another name is dropping, in Roger Sperry's lab.
Wow.
It was another Nobel laureate. So I just basically started summer work in his lab, and he was a famous neuroscientist. And I caught the bug then. And from then on, it was that's all I wanted to do.
Wow, yeah. And you wanted to be a physicist. Can we go back a little? I mean, wow, to run into Feynman in at Caltech and then to end up with Roger Sperry, that's quite.
Yes, I know.
Yeah. Well, two good rolls of the dice right there.
Well, the one thing that I emphasize in what I wrote is how much serendipity plays a role in this. And,
absolutely.
You know, I had to do a lot of introspection when I was asked to write this piece for the first time. It's a great experience for me. And I realized, and the message I give to students today is, it's important that you be smart enough and work hard enough and all these other things. Those are necessary but insufficient to be successful. There's a lot of luck involved and you don't have control over that.
That's true.
And I have been extremely lucky, and I'm not going to go into other stories about that. But it's very humbling to appreciate that.
And yet, right, I think that's a crucial point. There's a lot of luck in and happenstance and being around when a technology takes off or a specific theory comes around that... But you have to also have your eyes open, and you have to be open to luck. And that's another message, right?
You have to take advantage of luck when it avails itself. Yes, that's true.
Yeah. Tell me, can we backtrack even from Caltech? You know, when did you know you had the science bug? Is this a childhood thing? Did it come on later?
I was always I was a good student in school.
Right.
I enjoyed math and science quite a bit. And I remember... Sputnik came up as a shock to the country. It seemed patriotic to want to be a scientist and not allow Russia, the USSR at the time, to get ahead of us. And so my interest in actually love of math and physics that I had in high school, I had a physics teacher in high school that was fantastic, made its mark on me. And that's what I wanted to do.
That's wonderful, wonderful. A little patriotism thrown into the mix as well. That's fantastic. When you look at the current, or as a fast forward 2024, when you look at neuroscience today, where are the opportunities, and are there local minima? Are there cul-de-sacs we're running down that you think, you know, we're wasting our time on? So a bit of, you know, the positive and the negative here.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. Trying to predict the future is hopeless as far as I'm concerned. It's unpredictable. The only thing I would say that I think is missing in a lot of people's thinking about the brain is a grounding in evolution. And there are several missteps that I think are made because of that. There's too much emphasis on cerebral cortex, when my view is cortex is obviously important, but cortex didn't evolve to do anything that hasn't already been evolved by subcortical circuits to do, with maybe the exception of language and a few other things.
Right.
So I wish there was more of an evolutionary approach to studying the brain. I'm not sure how big a deal that is, but that's the one thing that I preach a lot.
Right.
Other than that, I think predicting where the field is going and the only other thing I would say that is a detriment is when we were both younger, there were a lot of models to study the brain, lots of species being studied. And right now it's almost all mice and monkeys.
Yeah.
And we work mostly on mice, and I think the challenge is always to come up with a question that you think is going to be generalized to mammals and not limited to mice. I'm not interested in mouse brains per se. I'm interested in what that can tell us about mammals. That becomes increasingly difficult because we don't have the stepping stones of other species to figure out what's actually general to mammals. I'm not sure why that came about. Probably funding agencies weren't so positive as they used to be about having a broad selection of species to study. But I think that is a problem going forward.
So it's a mistake to walk away from that sort of evolutionary chain, the fact that we have different complex.
Funding of evolutionary approaches to neuroscience used to be strong and is not here today.
Yeah, yeah. And do you worry, I mean, there's also a withdrawal from non-human primate work as well around the sort of political landscape. Does that worry you?
Yes, it does, because I think working in non-human primates is essential, absolutely essential. And I know there's a lot of pressure. For instance, we just were told that there's a bill in Congress to prevent the VA from supporting any more non-human primate research and feline research as it happens. And things like that would be devastating to the field, not just for the animals, but for humans. I mean, I don't think people really understand the importance of animals to human health and wellness. But I'm also
it's a battle we're losing, really, in the media and in publicity, right?
We're not doing a good enough job, I think. And I'm a little disappointed at the number of universities that are backing away from this and not standing up for what they should know better.
Agreed. Yeah, yeah. It's a tough time for universities. They're under a lot of pressure.
Tough. I wouldn't want to be a university president now. That's true.
Yes.
But I see that as a threat to the field going forward.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And do you see a way forward there? I mean, in some ways, we're being outflanked by the anti-scientific world in social media and media in general. Is there, you know, and of course, we don't have training in media, right? It's not like we get fundamental training in how to communicate like that.
Yeah, I agree. And people are losing their faith in science. This is all above my pay grade. I recognize the problem. I'm not sure what we can do about it because, you know, people like me aren't trained or have particular talents in getting to the general public. In fact, as you know, I've written quite a bit, a lot with Ray. We've written books. We made an attempt at one point to write for the general public. And I hadn't appreciated until we made that attempt and failed, by the way, how difficult that is.
It is difficult.
People that can, I have a new respect for people that do that and do that well.
Right, right.
I think that's extremely important, and that needs to be improved a lot, because if the general public understood better what was going on, I think we'd get the support that we need.
Right, right.
But we're not doing a good job of educating the general public.
There was even a period where we would shower scorn on the people who walked into that pop science space because they were, you know, painting with broad strokes and generalizing, but they were doing a great service to the community.
We were picking nuts, and that was silly.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. Hopefully we've changed our view about that and recognized that's an important niche that needs to be filled.
I think that's a really important point to make. You also served in a lot of leadership roles. We one of our points of contact is as fellow chairs of neuroscience departments at medical schools and that. Tell us a little bit about your leadership style and things, challenges that came up over the years, or just your thoughts about leading in the current academic environment.
I don't think there are any real tricks to it. My own approach is to delegate a lot, because, let other people, bring other people into positions where they have some authority. And of course, you always want to be honest and truthful with people. You have to learn to say no. That's hard for some people.
Right.
I'm not sure there's any particular trick. Some people, it either comes by naturally or you're not going to be good at it. Not everybody is good at doing that sort of thing.
Yeah. Mm.
I always felt, I enjoyed the leadership role. And I always sort of recognized for myself in academics that as far as I wanted to go as chair of a department, because I felt as chair, I was still a real faculty member. I don't mean this in a negative sense, but I would never want to be a dean or a provost or anything like that. I greatly admire those people who do it well. That's important. I just know that I would fail at it. That's all. So it's a leadership in general. I'm not sure what that means. There are certain kinds of leadership that I feel comfortable doing and others that I wouldn't.
Gotcha, yeah. If I may say, I think one of the things, I also had a seat watching the University of Chicago's neuroscience department thrive over the years, that having somebody in the leadership role with vision who is, who has the reputation that you have, that's a big part of it too. It provides an on-ramp for people. And it provides a vision and it provides a way forward. So,
yes, that was a new department that I took over. We started it. I'm extremely proud about the way it panned out. Very proud of that. I get much too much credit for it. I can live with that. But it worked because of the fact that the administration, the deans and the provost were very supportive the whole way through. It couldn't have been done without them. And there were a number of key faculty, neuroscience faculty and leadership when I arrived, that also were extremely important and helpful. They don't get much credit for this. So it was a team effort. And again, I'm proud of it. And it is what it is now. And as I mentioned before, I'm no longer the chair. And I'm now glad for that, because I realized there were a lot of things I was doing as chair that administrative things and bureaucratic things that I'd just as soon not be doing anymore. Leave it. But David Friedman is my colleague in the department. He's the new chair. He's fantastic. The department's in good hands, so I feel good about all of this.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I really appreciate you being here. I have one more question, because I think, a big component of our audience are young trainees coming into the field and people think about graduate school. And I always ask this question, looking at the field right now in 2024, what would you say to a youngster coming into the field? What do they need to keep their eyes open for? And is it a good time? Would you advise one of your own nieces or nephews?
That's a great question. I would, but there'd be some hesitation to it, because my concern is that people coming through now have a tougher time of making it than when I was a student. It was pretty easy for me. There aren't as many openings. If you really want to succeed in this field, it's imperative that you be able to compete successfully for funding, mostly from NIH or NSF or equivalent. That's become much more difficult as well.
Yeah.
And all I can say is that if you take the risk and are able to do those things, there's no better career. I mean, it's been fantastic. I feel like I've been doing a hobby I love and I'm getting paid for it. But I would, you know, if I'm really being honest and giving advice, I want them to make sure they understand the risks.
Yeah.
And the upside of that is that we're seeing students come into our programs now to get PhDs. 10 or 15 years ago, when I asked them, because I always ask students what they want to do in their careers, the answer was they want to be an academic scientist. Now, less than half say that, because they recognize the problems, they want to go into industry. So getting a PhD and sometimes even going further with postdoctoral training is still valuable if you want that career. So what I would advise students is, if you're at all interested, you don't have to decide now. You can get this kind of training, and maybe at the end of that time, things will be different than they are today. You don't have to decide now. I guess that's the advice I would give.
Excellent, excellent. Murray, I can't say how great an honor it is to get to know you personally over the last few years and just to have you here on Neuroscience.
Feelings mutual, and I really appreciate you asking me to do this.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.